The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine's February 9, 2026 edition. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital letters in gray, superimposed upon a starry black sky, in front of which is a portion of the moon. That is a photograph of a portion of the moon, which tends to be gradated from white through various levels of gray and into black. In front of that are the helmeted heads, photographed again, of astronauts, the Canadian Space Agency's Jeremy Hansen and NASA's Victor Glover, Reid Weissman, and Christina Cook. The helmets appear to be black, although they may be a dark, translucent gray. The people's faces are in profile, and their uniforms are primarily red with the NASA badge and additional badges. Beginning with this reading is the brief. Use of Force by Philip Wang. A death in Minneapolis brings the stakes of Trump's urban deployments into high relief. It is a full-page photograph in color by Philip Wang. It's a snowy ground, atop which are piled many bouquets of flowers in various colors. It looks like a summer garden except for the snow. Pink, red, yellow, purple, blue. Blue hydrangeas there. Yellow, I may have already said that. White. There's a person leaning on one knee on top of this snowy ground. It looks like a female, I'm not positive, but I'm seeing blue jeans, a blue jacket, a blue and green scarf, and a white knit hat, white gloves, one of which has been removed, and I'm seeing one black boot. The individual has one glove off the right hand and is placing a votive candle on the snow in front of the flowers. There are also a few signs. Most are illegible. They've probably been subjected to the weather. One says Justice for Renee, but there are other signs also. I'm turning the page now into the text. In the aftermath of the fatal shooting of Renee Good in Minneapolis, January 7, Trump administration officials jumped into a full-throated defense of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, agent responsible. The Department of Homeland Security maintained Agent Jonathan Ross dutifully acted in self-defense and sent hundreds more agents into the city, on top of the 2,000 whose presence had sparked widespread protests. The Pentagon, meanwhile, ordered 1,500 active duty soldiers in Alaska to prepare for a potential deployment to Minnesota, as President Donald Trump spoke of invoking the Insurrection Act of 1807. Then, January 20, Trump, who had initially posted on social media that Good viciously ran over the ICE officer, said that while he felt horribly about Good's death, agents are going to make mistakes sometimes while carrying out their work. And in fact, behind the scenes, current and former ICE agents were expressing concerns, not only about the agent's conduct, but also about the agency's operations in Minneapolis and a broader push by the Trump administration to aggressively recruit more agents. I am embarrassed, one former ICE agent with more than 25 years experience told Time. The majority of my colleagues feel the same way. It is an insult to us because we did it the right way to see what they are doing now. When asked about the deadly shooting, both that former agent and a current ICE agent expressed their reservations about Ross, the agent who shot 37-year-old Good, opening fire three times. If someone's able to make the argument that she was trying to hit him, he feared for his life, and all he could do was shoot, then sure, he can justify it that way, said the current ICE agent, who has more than 20 years' experience in the agency. Agency policy would allow such a reaction in the case of imminent danger. But I think when you look at it a little bit more, it's very problematic for him. Now, moving from the text again to photographs, these two pages I'm looking at contain a page and a half of photographs. They're all in color. Many are peopled by individuals in camouflage uniforms carrying what look to me like heavy-duty weapons. Most have police on the back of a vest that they're wearing, but not all. Some are also mixed in who are wearing blue jeans and blue jackets, and not the camouflage uniforms. So it looks like a real mixture here. I'll just read a couple of captions. One says, a federal officer in Minneapolis takes an individual who could not prove proof of citizenship into custody January 12. And that's a photograph by Scott Olson. The sky is blue with lots of white clouds. The ground is mushy looking to me. We see the gray concrete on top of which are splotches of white ice or snow or slush. The agent seems to be working, well, I shouldn't say anonymously, but I can't see the face of the person. This individual is again wearing khaki throughout with police stamped on the back of the vest being worn. And there's some kind of headgear on. It looks like a head warming, not scarf, but head warmer. But when it looks, the person being detained looks like a little kid to me. Of course, it could be a small adult there, but it's about two-thirds the size of the agent who's talking to the person. And then one other photograph that I will read the caption of is a whole, let's see, I'm not going to say a whole bunch, I'm going to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, at least 7, probably 8 pairs of feet I'm seeing. Yeah, 8 pairs of feet here. Heading for the front door of a home. And there's a mailbox attached to the wall near the door of the home. There's a woman standing in the doorway. It looks like she's dressed in a hospital-type uniform. It's dark green. And she is looking at all these people with all their guns in alarm. That is, her mouth is wide open and her eyes are wide open and she has a phone in her hand. The caption reads, federal officers approach the Minneapolis home of Tayana Gibson Brown, January 11. Agents broke down the door and arrested her husband. The photograph is by John Locker, AP. Okay, returning to the text again. This is a page long. Still the same brief opener, the use of force. The current and former agents spoke on condition of anonymity because they're not authorized to speak on the record. The DHS told Time Good had weaponized her vehicle, attempting to run over our law enforcement officers in an attempt to kill them, an act of domestic terrorism. Videos of the incident contradict that account. They appear to show Ross positioned to the side of Good's vehicle when he fired three shots that killed her, with her wheels turned away from him. Both the former agent and the current agent also question why Ross was assigned to this operation in the first place. Given a previous injury involving a driver at the wheel of a vehicle just a few months before the confrontation with Good. So when this person took off, I'm sure that prior incident came to mind because he is an experienced officer, and then he just reacted, in my opinion, not in the correct way, the former agent said. As in Trump's deployments of federal forces to other Democrat-controlled cities, politics arrived with the more than 3,000 agents from ICE and Customs and Border Protection who began arriving in the Twin Cities late last year. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said on social media the agents were there to conduct a massive investigation on child care and other rampant fraud, an investigation that came after right-wing influencer Nick Shirley claimed that daycare centers in Minneapolis run by Somali residents are sham operations and had misappropriated more than $100 million. The state inspector launched a probe following the claim and said the daycare centers were operating as expected. The current ICE agent pointed out neither Border Patrol officers nor ICE agents in charge of deportation, also known as enforcement and removal operations, ERO, officers, are trained to investigate financial fraud. In a more typical situation, a specialized team from Homeland Security Investigations might conduct such a probe. None of those skills were asked for when they sought out volunteers or when they pulled people. It was just, we just need people to go out there and flood the area, the current ICE agent said. The surge in Minneapolis is part of a broad nationwide push by the Trump administration to meet the president's aim to carry out the largest deportation operation in American history. To that end, ICE has doubled its manpower from 10,000 to 22,000 in less than a year, thanks to an aggressive hiring campaign. The massive surge of new officers also prompted ICE to shorten the training at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Georgia from 13 weeks to 6 weeks, as NBC first reported. The former agent called that a recipe for disaster. You cannot train someone to do all the basic law enforcement stuff in 6 weeks, let alone the law, the current agent said. Immigration law used to be a 5 or 6 month course at the academy. How do you know people are here legally unless you know the law? You use Google? The former agent added the consequences of rushed recruitment could be compounded in the future when more senior ICE agents plan for retirement. They'll be replaced by hastily trained recruits who lack the legal and enforcement knowledge of the generation they are replacing. Some retired agents have also been invited by ICE to rejoin the force. But according to the former agent, the risks of going back are enough to persuade many to stay retired. If you are ordered to do something, and you know you're violating the law, and you say no, then you stand a chance of being terminated. Then you jeopardize your pension, the former agent said, adding that some officers are asked to work 16-hour shifts, 6 to 7 days a week. For most of us, it's not worth it. Even before Good's shooting, public support for the agency had been dropping sharply. A mid-January CBS YouGov poll showed 61% of Americans think ICE is being too tough when stopping and detaining people, and 52% think the agency is making communities less safe. Asked about the public's biggest misconception about ICE, both the current and former agent said that ICE, like all government agencies, is at the mercy of the administration. Where was all this energy when the election was happening? Everyone knew this was what the administration was going to do, one agent said, adding that for the most part, the agents conducting deportations and arrests are not breaking the law. You are putting people in a position where if they object, they have to quit and try to find work in a really bad job market, the agent said. So they justify themselves and say, hey, it's legal, and as long as I'm not violating rights or doing something immoral or illegal, I'm going to do it because this is what the American voters voted for. Okay, next page, snowed under. Well, this is another photo that's almost half a page. The snow is blue and white. It's been drifted. It looks like it was naturally drifted, but it's also been shoveled because there are piles on either side of a very narrow pathway. In the background are some mountains. And they look like they're brown and white, as in snow-covered trees. And beyond that, a lot of icy white-blue sky. And here's the caption, snowed under. Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula is experiencing its heaviest snowfall in 6 decades, with some regions recording more than 6.5 feet of snow in the first few weeks of January. Siberian winds carrying moisture from the Sea of Okhotsk routinely make the peninsula one of the snowiest places, but as pedestrians found January 19, snowplows have been overmatched. Okay, marching toward the foreground in this photo, a man and a woman, both bundled for the weather, except they're not wearing anything on their hands, no gloves or mittens. But what the woman is just striding past is the top, I'm going to say, half of a car roof. That's all that's obvious from where the snow's been shoveled. All right, the bulletin, why rebranding the Defense Department could cost millions, by Chantel Lee. In September, President Donald Trump signed an executive order directing that the Department of Defense, DOD, will be renamed the Department of War, saying it was a much more appropriate name, especially in light of where the world is right now. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said his agency is going to go on defense. Excuse me, let me read that over. Is going to go on offense, not just defense. Maximum lethality, not tepid legality. Beyond any impact on Trump's unrequited pursuit of a Nobel Peace Prize, the rebranding could cost taxpayers as much as $125 million, according to a report released January 14 by the Congressional Budget Office, CBO. The report estimates that a modest implementation of the order would cost roughly $10 million, whereas a change that was implemented broadly and rapidly throughout the department could come with a price tag as high as $125 million. Costs associated with rebranding the department include time that staff members would spend updating websites and letterheads rather than working on other tasks. The estimate also includes funds used for signs or ceremonial objects. Democratic Senators Jeff Merkley and Chuck Schumer requested the CBO report following Trump's executive order. The office said, however, that its estimates are uncertain because DOD has not provided information about how it plans to implement this rebranding. The CBO was able to obtain a report that lists $1.9 million in renaming costs spent by 5 Office of the Secretary of Defense organizations, but the CBO points out that list is not exhaustive and is likely an underestimate. Before a full-scale change can be implemented, Congress would need to pass legislation approving the adjustment. Until then, the Department of War will serve as a secondary title for the agency. Months after Trump signed the executive order, Congress has not taken up the case. The brief news. More photos here. World is the subtitle. Iranian protesters say Trump betrayed them, by K. Armin Serjoy. Demonstrators on the streets of Tehran, January 8. Okay, these are nighttime photos, so mainly we see backgrounds in black or very bright lights in contrast to the black. There are people with arms raised. I think they're surrounding a bonfire. I see orangey, yellow, white coloration, but I don't really see any flames, but there's something going on. And then in the second photo, it's a traffic jam. It's just car after car after car on a five-lane highway. I don't know where they're going, but it's just a nighttime expedition of many, many, many cars. Okay, seven times in 8 days, U.S. President Donald Trump promised to come to the aid of Iranian protesters if the country's authoritarian regime began killing them in the streets, which it did, slaying thousands January 8 and 9. Trump doubled down. Keep protesting, he urged. On Truth Social, January 12, help is on its way. Yet none came. Even after the Pentagon, in a move that often signals combat is imminent, ordered non-essential personnel evacuated from Al Udeid Air Base, the largest U.S. military facility in the Middle East. At the same time, international flights began avoiding Iranian airspace. But to the dismay of Iranians who spoke to Time in the days that followed, the moment passed. Within a day, non-essential workers were headed back on base, and Trump went from threatening Iran's mullahs to thanking them for what he called a promise on very good authority that arrested protesters would not be executed. Everyone was enraged, a Tehran resident said shortly after Trump's reversal. They just kept saying, this bastard used us as cannon fodder. Iranians feel they were played. He fooled them, deceived them. He's not only yellow on the outside, said an art teacher in the capital. He's also yellow inside. He screwed up. He pulled the rug from under our feet, fumed a 40-year-old businessman, also in Tehran, who, after seeing a satellite news report of the Help Is On Its Way post, said he called friends and relatives with the good news. Trump is worse than Obama, he said. The nationwide protests appeared to be the largest in the 47-year existence of the Islamic Republic. They first erupted in Tehran's Grand Bazaar, December 28, in response to the abrupt, catastrophic devaluation of Iran's currency, then spread across the country. In the past, 2009, 2017, 2019, 2022, mass protests had been crushed by Iran's notoriously brutal security services. But January 2, 5 days into these, Trump leveled a warning. If Iran shoots and violently kills peaceful protesters, he wrote on Truth Social, the United States of America will come to their rescue. We are locked and loaded and ready to go. Coming from the president who had ordered U.S. bombers to join Israel in attacking Iran's nuclear program last June, the threat was seen as credible. Iranians took heart. Crowds grew. Thursday, January 8, the start of the Iranian weekend, millions took to the streets, urged on by exiled Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi and other opposition groups. The regime responded, first as it had done in the past before directing live fire into groups of its own citizens. It disconnected the nation of 90 million from the Internet, also cutting cell phones, SMS, and landlines. Then security forces mounted an onslaught on a scale not previously seen. The final death toll is not known. Iranian authorities, known for undercounting, January 21 announced 3,117 deaths. Tallies compiled by physicians and activists, citing discrete surveys of hospitals and morgues, run from 12,000 to 16,500 deaths. Witnesses say most of the deaths came when the streets were fullest. When I saw a man a few meters ahead of me fall backwards, I did not understand what happened, said the businessman, describing a scene January 8 on a Tehran street. When we gathered round him, all I could see in the dark night was a red spot on his forehead. It was only when the blood from the back of his head pooled at our feet that we realized he had been shot by a sniper. While the regime carried out the attacks, he said, Trump is also responsible for the death of these 15,000 because many of the protesters took to the streets when they saw his post that the U.S. is locked and loaded. He said he could only suspect a deal had been struck between the U.S. and the Islamic Republic to betray Iranians like this. Protesters faced fire whenever they gathered in Zirab, a city of around 20,000 in the north of Iran. A 39-year-old man said on January 9, chanting protesters were forced down a street, only to see the way ahead blocked with security forces at their back. Then the streetlights went out and machine guns started shooting, he said. Nothing could be seen. Everyone was falling down, either from bullets or not seeing ahead of them, trying to get away. The resident said he did not know how many died, but in the next few days heard about as many as 17 missing. In Tehran, Iran's rulers publicly gloated after Trump thanked them January 16 for what he called a promise to abandon planned executions. Iran canceled the hanging of over 800 people, Trump told reporters who asked about the drawdown on preparations for a strike on Iran. That had a big impact. Trump says a lot of nonsense and gibberish, Tehran's prosecutor Ali Salehi declared a day later, according to state TV. Our reaction will be forceful, preventive, and swift. Indictments have been issued for numerous cases and sent to courts. Ordinary Iranians reached by Starlink, the satellite internet service unaffected by the internet blackout, or during brief resumptions in communications, complained of living with the consequences of Trump's reticence. It's already martial law, said a woman in Tehran. Now, after Trump went back on his word, they've become even more brazen. I saw a checkpoint on Mazandaran Boulevard where they were checking the cell phones of people. I've lost all hope, she said. Trump's not going to do anything. Why should he? He doesn't care about us. Some, however, say they retain hope Trump still might act. My husband believes that this is Trump's usual pattern, to confuse them, Iran's rulers, the woman went on. He says if Trump does not attack, how can the regime be toppled? Iranians are doing everything they can, but the regime is just too savage. An engineer in Tehran also saw the pivot as tactical. He's tricking the regime. He'll attack and attack hard. He's going to go after Zahak himself, the engineer said, referring to the most evil character in Iranian mythology, used by protesters to describe Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. There cannot be any other option, he added. It's different this time. The businessman said his own belief that the current uprising will prove effective informed his decision to stay behind when his wife and child flew out of the country shortly after the bloodletting. But he says the protesters would need help. The people on the streets did all they could do. We were facing machine guns on pickup trucks, empty-handed. The only way we can win is with foreign intervention, like Kosovo or Bosnia. 2 weeks after the bloody weekend, the regime was claiming victory, and Trump was again talking tough. We have an armada heading in that direction, he said, January 23. Maybe we won't have to use it. Iranians took note, but no one was venturing into the streets. Right now, the uprising is paralyzed, said the man from Zirab. I don't know if it will ever recover. From the milestones page, not too much here today, two columns plus a few more on the lower part of the page that are short. I'll read those first. Killed at least 41 people in a train crash in southern Spain, January 18. The crash, which left dozens wounded, occurred when the end of one train went off the rails and collided with another. One, that's W-O-N, the first ever college football national championship by the Indiana Hoosiers, January 19. Indiana University beat Miami 27-21 to cap a perfect season, another first for the team. Died Claudette Colvin, C-O-L-V-I-N, the civil rights icon, who preceded Rosa Parks in refusing to give up an Alabama bus seat at 86, January 13. Fashion designer Valentino, January 19, at 93. Died Bob Weir, W-E-I-R, Grateful Dead co-founder and guitarist, his family said, January 10, at 78. Scott Adams, creator of the satirical workplace comic strip Dilbert, January 13, at 68. Here are the milestones columns. The first is written by Alice Park, withdrawn the U.S. from the WHO, a shrinking health community. The U.S. was one of the first countries to join the World Health Organization, WHO, when it was created in 1948 as part of the UN. But January 2, it officially withdrew from the Global Health Group. The U.S. has historically been the largest funder of the WHO through both its assessed and voluntary contributions. So the departure is poised to disrupt both global and domestic health. One of the first things that could change for U.S. scientists is their access to databases that are important for monitoring infectious diseases like influenza, as well as emerging threats that could affect the health of Americans like COVID. The withdrawal of the U.S. from the global health community also has important geopolitical implications. While the WHO's policies are determined by consensus, the absence of the U.S. creates room for other countries to exert more influence. And since the U.S. has been the largest funder of the WHO, the withdrawal has forced Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, its director general, to revise the budget and rely less heavily on dominant donors. The effects on U.S. and global health will be a slow bleed, says Dr. Judd Walson, chair of international health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Most Americans will not wake up January 23 and say, look what happened when the U.S. withdrew from WHO. But the problem is that the impacts will be difficult to reverse once they happen. And the final column by Chantel Lee, sold Venezuelan oil, valued at $500 million. After the U.S. military operation that led to the capture of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. would seize and sell up to 50 million barrels of the South American nation's oil. Now that plan's playing out, as a Trump administration official confirmed to Time January 14 that the White House has secured its first sale of Venezuelan oil. White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers said in a statement the president brokered a historic energy deal with Venezuela, one that will benefit the American and Venezuelan people. She added, Trump's team is working with oil companies that are ready and willing to make unprecedented investments to restore Venezuela's oil infrastructure. An administration official said the first sale is valued at $500 million and that more are expected to be finalized soon. Trump has previously said the U.S. will take control of the oil industry in Venezuela. That was the milestones page. Next, the brief news. Good question. What does Trump really want with Greenland? By Connor Green. There's a photo here. Well, it looks like a calendar page, actually. It's not a very large photo, but it's colorful. The background is the sky, and it's gray. The foreground is white, and it's snow. Off to the left, it looks like a body of water because it's grayish-blue with chunks of white snow in it. On the hillside, which is the snow, are many very pretty houses. Well, maybe they're businesses, too. They're buildings. They look like cottages to me. In all shades of colors, we've got yellow, pink, green, yellow, red, blue, another green. The roofs all appear to be gray, and the roofs are somewhat spotted with white, like snow. President Donald Trump has had his sights set on Greenland for years. He first offered to buy the island, an autonomous territory within the Kingdom of Denmark, in 2019 during his first term, in what he described as essentially a real estate deal. Since his re-election, he's redoubled the push to acquire the territory and repeatedly threatened to annex it, despite pushback from Greenland itself, Denmark, leaders of other European countries, and even some prominent members of his own party. The island looms large on maps from the distorting effects of flattening a globe, but for the U.S., it's uniquely well situated to monitor Russian and Chinese military activity. The president has cast his interest in acquiring Greenland as being primarily motivated by national security concerns. The island is situated along the Greenland, Iceland, United Kingdom, GIUK gap. That's GAP, a strategic choke point for surveillance in the Arctic region. Greenland also holds rich natural resources, including oil, rare earth minerals, and uranium, an important element for nuclear power. Rare earth minerals, which are abundant in Greenland, are useful for technologies ranging from defense to renewable energy, says Salim Ali, a professor of energy and environment at the University of Delaware. These offerings add to the island's strategic importance and its appeal for the U.S. In trade negotiations, China this year leveraged U.S. dependence on its rare earths to negotiate tariff relief from Trump. Actually, getting to the minerals is complicated by the ice sheets that cover 80% of Greenland. and a lack of roads and infrastructure in the remaining 20%. But climate change and melting ice have allowed for further exploration, international shipping, and military presence in the area, making it increasingly competitive. Russia, which stretches over half of the Arctic Ocean coastline, currently controls a majority of the region. Though the president has dismissed the idea that resources play a significant role in his push to acquire Greenland, Mike Waltz, W-A-L-T-Z, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and Trump's former national security advisor, said in a 2024 interview with Fox that the administration's interest was about critical minerals and natural resources. Greenland is so strategic in a world where China and Russia have major Arctic ambitions, Nick Burns, former U.S. ambassador to NATO and U.S. ambassador to China, tells Time, noting Russia considers itself to be the Arctic power, and therefore it's very important that the United States up its game. And China declared itself a near Arctic state in 2018, releasing a strategy plan for Arctic exploration and shipping. But as Trump doubles down, experts point out the U.S. does not need to fully control the territory to benefit from either its strategic security position or natural resources. There's a way for the Trump administration to get what it says it wants, and that's mineral access and military bases, by doing something that should be normal, Burns says, and that is respecting Denmark, working with them diplomatically on the basis the Danes have suggested. We are sovereign, but we welcome American investment and military presence. A defense treaty from 1951 between the U.S. and Denmark already grants the U.S. the right to construct, install, maintain, and operate military bases there. I think it's clear we do not need to invade Greenland or even buy it to get what President Trump says he wants, Burns says. Likewise, Ali says the U.S. does not need to control the island to use its resources. There's been no curtailment of U.S. investment going into there, he says. And more important, and a greater asset to U.S. national security than dominance in the Arctic, Burns stresses, is the country's membership in NATO. It is in the American national interest that we stay in NATO, he says, calling the coalition our vehicle for international protection. The stakes are so high here, he says. Here is the brief health. 5 doctor-approved ways to use AI for health information by Angela Haupt. Last summer, Lance Johnson woke up in the middle of the night with excruciating pain in his lower right side. He initially blamed it on the pizza and ice cream he enjoyed the night before. But 5 sleepless hours later, the 17-year-old from Phoenix was still suffering, so he decided to consult the nearest expert, ChatGPT. I described what I had eaten the night before and where the pain was, and I was like, "Do you think it's just my stomach?" Then it said that it sounded like it was appendicitis, based on how long it was lasting and where it was, Johnson says. I kept asking it more questions, like could it be anything else, and it said, based on what you described, you should get it checked out. Johnson followed the bot's advice, and sure enough, the doctors at the emergency room soon said he did, in fact, have appendicitis and needed immediate surgery. When he told them he suspected as much because of ChatGPT's insights, I think they were kind of surprised that it would answer something like that, that it would diagnose me before they did, Johnson says. I didn't know anything about appendicitis before. I didn't even know it was in the bottom right. Similar scenarios are playing out across the country as AI tools usurp Dr. Google. That usage will likely continue to grow. In January, OpenAI announced a new feature called ChatGPT Health, a hub where people can upload their medical records, including lab results, visit summaries, and clinical histories. While there are potential risks like privacy concerns or receiving inaccurate, outdated, or generic information, some doctors say AI platforms can be helpful if you know how to use them the right way. We asked providers to share the smartest ways patients can use AI platforms. Okay, and here are five coming up. One, plug in lots of details. Dr. Colin Banas suggests querying large language models, LLMs, like this. I'm a 48-year-old male who's completed X level of education, and I need to understand what this diagnosis is and what potential treatment options might be. The bot will give you good answers in a comprehensible way, says Banas. That's B-A-N-A-S. Chief Medical Officer of Dr. First, a healthcare technology company. The more details and context you provide the tool, the better equipped it will be to disperse information that is actually pertinent. Two, ask unbiased questions. Instead of asking an LLM like ChatGPT or Claude why chemotherapy is preferred over immunotherapy for a certain type of cancer, for example, ask the tool whether chemotherapy or immunotherapy is preferred and to explain the pros and cons of each. AI tools are not foolproof, says Dr. Adil Khan, an assistant professor of medicine and public health at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. How it's framed makes a difference. Three, let it help you decode medical jargon. If you're stumped by an oncologist's repeated use of the word grade, ask the LLM what it means, and within seconds you'll have a brief, easy-to-understand explanation. AI tools are really good at breaking down doctor speak, Banas says. Four, use it to prepare for doctor's appointments. Tools like ChatGPT can help you formulate better questions to take to your doctor. Patients use it to prepare for their visits ahead of time, Banas says. They'll say, here are my symptoms. What are some questions I should ask my doctor? If you find the questions useful, Banas recommends writing them down or taking screenshots you can show your doctor. And five, use it to brainstorm lifestyle changes. Some people use AI tools for meal plan suggestions, exercise plans, or tips on products that might soothe a skin condition. Those uses exemplify the positive potential of AI tools. Information is power, says Laura Sparkman, a longtime registered nurse who's now a clinical strategist at Relias, a healthcare, tech, and education company. Patients have these tools at their fingertips, and they're going to lead to a shift in conversations. The brief news, climate, the women, saving America's climate data by Kyla Mandel. This may be abridged. A couple of weeks after Donald Trump was elected president for the second time, a group of federal data watchers gathered in Denise Ross's dining room. As chief U.S. data scientist under the Biden administration, Ross had a clear window into just how much information the government collects. Whether monitoring a fleet of ocean buoys to guide safe shipping routes or tracking how vulnerable communities are to disaster, and just how useful it is. Over the course of that evening, Ross and her guests took down all the pictures decorating her walls, and in their place began sticking post-it notes, mapping everything that could, in their view, go wrong if the administration targeted the bedrock of science, the collection, analysis, and sharing of data. It had happened in 2017 and could happen again if Trump's promises to undo climate policy, along with targeting other areas like health, were anything to go by. Soon the room was full of little paper squares detailing all the information that could be at risk and ideas for how to monitor and protect against its possible dilution or even its removal from public view. 1 year into Trump's presidency, pretty much everything has come to pass, says Ross, now a senior advisor at the Federation of American Scientists, except much quicker than I expected. It started the day after Trump's inauguration last year, when the Climate and Economic Justice Screening Tool, launched under President Joe Biden, was taken offline, but not for long. 48 hours later, it was resurrected by the Public Environmental Data Partners, PEDP, a new coalition launched in November 2024 to save federal data. For over a year now, more than a dozen groups have been working together to rescue environment and climate data, and the majority are being led by women. Behind the scenes, countless other volunteers and organizations are plugging away, preferring to stay out of the limelight. They're part of a vast web that has emerged since President Trump's election, made up of dozens of groups across sectors, all working to keep federal databases alive. So far, at least 360 environment-specific data sets have been backed up, along with 311,000 data sets from data.gov and nearly 710 terabytes of Smithsonian data. The list goes on. It is more than just archiving data that may be restricted or deleted. Historical data give a picture of society and the planet at a given point in time, and it's essential for analyzing trends. But unless this library of data, a library funded by taxpayers, is available to everyone, it will not be able to do what it was gathered to do, help us understand our world and guide decisions. So now the question becomes, how do we actually make it so that these aren't just sitting in servers somewhere without people using them, says Brittany Janus, Executive Director of the Open Environmental Data Project, OEDP. The whole goal of this was for this data to continue being usable and accessible. The first 100 days after Trump's election are a blur for Gretchen Gehrke, the website monitoring program lead at the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative, EDGI, which was formed ahead of Trump's first presidency. Like Ross, Gehrke started saving data before Trump took office. Her first target? A database of 21,500 risk management plans for facilities with toxic or hazardous chemicals. No one was prepared for the scale and speed at which events were about to unfold. In its first 3 months, the second Trump administration made 70% more changes to official environmental websites than were made during the same period of his first presidency. As of December 2025, 18 federal data resources were either taken down, discontinued, or had significant elements removed. This includes the Environmental Protection Agency's, EPA, Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's, NOAA, Billion Dollar Weather and Climate Disasters Tracker, since relaunched by the nonprofit Climate Central. For its part, the administration has said the erasure of various resources has been due to reasons ranging from staffing changes to ending the shameful discrimination of diversity initiatives. Collaboration quickly became essential. There was no sense in being territorial about it, says Linda Kellum, who co-founded the Data Rescue Project last February. Everyone was sprinting as fast as they could. We had folks within agencies saying, I'm the last person within this agency that has this data. Can you please back it up? Says Jesse Marr, a director of technology at the Environmental Policy Innovation Center, EPIC. There was a spreadsheet that prioritized the various data sets to save, and everyone just worked their way down the list. At the top, environmental justice information. Cameron Kerger had been working on federal environmental justice data since 2021, most recently for the White House Office of Environmental Justice at the Council on Environmental Quality. At the end of 2024, Kerger became concerned about what might happen to the data she had dedicated her federal career to. Others outside the government were also worried, so one of the first big efforts was to save the climate and economic justice screening tool, which Kerger worked on as lead designer and researcher. It is thanks to several groups' coordination that PEDP was able to rebuild the tool so quickly. Once her government service ended, January 25, 2025, Kerger joined EPIC, part of PEDP, and promptly began working on their copy of the tool. To this day, says Gehrke, the most thoroughly eviscerated information and data are about equity. The last article was only slightly abridged, and we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.